Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. On January 17th, Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+, and we can't wait for you guys to see it.
And before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recap podcasts.
Yep. Each weekday beginning January 7th, we'll be dropping an episode featuring exclusive behind-the-scenes tidbits and brilliant insights from our cast and crew and us.
Patricia Arquette, Britt Lauer, Zach Cherry, John Turturro, the list goes on.
All your favorite Lumen employees, their friends, families, enemies, in your feed every single weekday.
And here's the best part. After that, we're going to keep going. Tune in weekly as we recap every episode of season 2. The podcast drops on the same day the episode comes out.
It's the Severance Podcast with Ben and Adam.
On Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another edition of News You Can Use. I'm Ann Baldwin. And hey, before we get to our guest today, I want to remind people that the Biggest Little Fair in Connecticut's coming up in September. That's right. It's the 75th annual Berlin Fair, September 12th to the 15th. And if you know anybody out there who's got talent, I don't care what it is. Maybe you play the accordion. Maybe you're a dancer. Maybe you're a singer. You've got to get online right now and sign up for Berlin's Got Talent. Auditions are coming up September 4th and September 6th, 5 to 8 p.m. It's going to be at the Berlin Fairgrounds. All you have to do is go to ctberlinfair.com, sign up. It's amazing some of the people that have come out of Berlin's Got Talent. Jordan Oakes, who many of you know, is now a recording Nashville recording star. We've had some little kids that have been on there. It's absolutely adorable. So again, a shout out to anybody out there who has got talent, whether you're a kid, whether you're a senior citizen. It's really a fun event, and there are also cash prizes because they're going to be able to perform. If you make it to the semifinals and then the finals, you'll be performing live on September 13th, which is a Friday, and Saturday, September 14th. You could walk away with prize money of more than $2,000. So go to ctberlinfair.com for more information. So I'm so excited, all the way from Sarasota, Florida, right?
Right.
In the house today, we have Deb Lawless Miller. And Deb, your story is really an amazing one. It touched my heart. It touched me because I've also been through the journey that you've been through, but you at least took the time to write a book. And she's the author of One Little Pill, The Chase, The Crash, The Choice. What an amazing book. And I appreciate you coming into the studio and sharing your story. It's not easy, right?
Right. Well, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Absolutely. So let's start with the basics, Deb. And, you know, it's kind of like when you speak at a meeting, right? Mm-hmm. What happened?
Well, what happened was I was given a Vicodin. It's as simple as that. I literally was very hungover one night. In the morning after a party, and a friend handed me a Vicodin, and everything washed away, and I felt so. This feeling of, oh my gosh, this is the best feeling ever. I can live life on this, feeling like this forever and ever. And it was just a one-time thing.
How old were you?
I was at that time 23.
23 yeah. years old. And, you know, we've all been there, hungover.
Right.
And,
right.
you know, they call it the hair of the dog. So someone right. gives you a Vicodin.
Yeah.
And that was it?
Well, I knew then that this was like a really special feeling. Like prior to that, I had been a drinker. But nothing excessively, you know, I loved going out and having drinks, but I didn't wake up in the morning or the next day craving them. I was like, I love that party, that buzz, all of that. But I never felt like I had any desire to like get up and drink the next day or the next night, you know, it was just like, but when I took that one pill, I was like, how do I get more? I mean, it was literally like something in my brain just triggered.
Oh, I know. I can tell you, I've had that experience too with alcohol, in that, you know, when one sip and there's something in your brain, like a vein or something that warms up. And that's why you titled the first chapter of your book, Where It All Began.
Right.
And you said one little pill changed your life forever.
For sure.
So what did you do from that point?
So at that point, I was engaged to be married. So I wasn't even married at that point. But my fiance at the time, he was also, you know, he also had some Vicodin and felt the same way. So we had that in common. We were like, ooh, this is good.
Dangerous combination.
Right, exactly. And we had access, easy access to it through our friend. And and so it became like a weekend thing. You know, it became like a, at the time, I had just moved to outside of Philadelphia for his job. And so on the weekends, we would, you know, partake and have a couple cocktails, a couple pills. And it was just something that, you know, we both looked forward to, you know, which was a red flag, I guess, you know, when you think about it. And then, but what happened was I started wanting more frequently. And but I didn't want him to know. This is all where the whole lies and shame and I don't want to be called out on it. All of that starts, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we would go on our way during the week and to work. And I happened to work at a job where it was a home infusion company, and we dealt with a lot of people that were end stage life. And a lot of times these patients would pass. And I became really close friends with a guy who worked there who would go out to his job was going out to the home and collecting the home infusion stuff and all the medication.
That weren't used after someone passed away.
Yes.
I know where you're going with this.
Yeah. So he had, one day we were eating lunch, having a conversation, and he brought up like opioids and, oh, this is great. And I was like, you know, I shared with him that, oh yeah, I really love those. And he just shows me this bag full of stuff. And he's like, I'll, you know, if you want to share these with me, you know, you're welcome to. And I was like, oh my gosh. So then I started having my own little stash, and I didn't share it with my fiance because A, I didn't want to share with him.
Yeah, right.
He would have been like, can I have some? And you know, and secondly, you know, I knew that I shouldn't be taking pills to get through the day, but I felt like I needed to. So that became like the first kind of lie and denial and shame. And then he went off, his fiance called him out on what was going on, and off to rehab he went. So then I found myself without my quote-unquote supplier.
And that's when you get desperate.
Yes, but I also, again, I wasn't like, oh, I need these, I'm going to have, you know, trouble functioning if I don't have that. It was just like, all right, well, it's over. But then I went through a terrible withdrawal. And again, I was so naive to all of this. I never knew anything about drug addiction or alcoholism. So
it didn't run in your family?
No. And I had a really great upbringing, you know, a family unit. I have two older brothers. My parents are still married, 57, 58 years.
So no real
trauma.
No trigger, no trauma. And you know, that's the other thing. When I was in rehab, you know, I've got 12 years sober. One of the things that they really work with you on is like, what's your trigger? What happened? What traumatic?
Right.
You know, but there are people that get addicted that don't have one.
Right.
And, you know, that was my struggle. I mean, I did find I had some triggers, but some people don't. And the other thing that's interesting, too, I remember being when I was in the rehab and we were all sitting in our big circle and sharing our experiences. And one guy said, I'll never forget the first time he said that I tried an opioid.
Yeah.
And he said, I said to the drug dealer, how long is this going to last? Because I have to be home for dinner. And the dealer said, for the rest of your life.
Oh my gosh, that is really powerful.
It is powerful.
And it's so true.
Yes. So then what happens after that? So you're in this relationship and then.
Yeah. So I think at this point, we were married. I because time had gone by. But we were married at this point because we were living in, still working in Philly, but living in New Jersey. And I remember like, okay, no more supply, and getting violently ill, and not correlating that I was detoxing. I just thought I had a really bad stomach flu or whatever. So, and it lasted for like 2 weeks. I couldn't get out of bed. I was sick as a dog, shaking the whole nine yards, sweating, shaking, everything. And so I just said to my husband at the time, I'm like, I want to die. I really do. Please, I can't go on like this anymore. And what I didn't realize was psychologically I was disconnecting from the opioids because my chemicals had already switched. Mm-hmm. And I was physically detoxing, but the emotional and psychological detox was still there even after I started physically feeling better. So he thinks that I'm suicidal, and he brings me to the doctor, and the doctor ends up prescribing some antidepressants, which I go on. And then I'm clean for a while, you know, and life is good, and we both have jobs and working, everything's great. And that's when we tried to get pregnant. And I did get pregnant, and I had a miscarriage. And that sent me spiraling. So when I say spiraling, I mean like, and I know there's so many women who have miscarriages, and it's such a dark place, and it's such a place of grief and sadness for something and somebody you've never even met. But anyways, I noticed then that I started having significant depression episodes. And to get out of that, I didn't turn to drugs. I didn't turn to the drugs, but I did start drinking again.
Well, let's go back, because I want to go back to the book. Sure. And again, we're talking with Deb Lawless Miller, and the title of her book is One Little Pill. Let's go back to when you had the miscarriage, and I just want to read a little excerpt from the book. And you talk about that. You said, what do I do about this? Because as you had sat down on the toilet, I mean, you had your miscarriage. And here's a quote from your book. It says, "What do I do about this?" I ask, looking through tears down into the bowl where my unborn baby is, somewhere in all that blood, with tears welling. She says, "You need to flush it, honey." Wow.
Yeah. I know.
So the impact of that.
Yeah.
Devastating.
Yeah, devastating. And that's what I had to do because I had miscarried in the toilet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was, again, it just, I spiraled at that point. But what I hung on to was that I thought, okay, well, at least we know we can get pregnant because that won't be a challenge. Mm-hmm. But it ended up being a huge challenge. You know, we went through infertility treatments for years. And finally, you know, I was blessed with my son. We were blessed with my son. And I just, it took a while to rebound from that. And then the drinking started. But it didn't get out of control because I was so focused on getting pregnant again. And so about 2 years after is when we had my son Hunter.
You know, one of the other things that you said in the book too, you always said to yourself at times, I cannot imagine living a sober life. Mm-hmm. It gets to that point, right?
Oh yeah.
Where you just say, I just can't imagine life without the pill, life without the alcohol. It's hard to, you know, really engage that because you're so messed up.
Yeah.
Your body's so messed up. So then you have your son, but let's talk a little bit about your shame. You know, you said your shame fuels your denial fuels your shame, that you're really, that it was your drugs that were your smoke screen. Mm-hmm. So did your family know? Did your husband know? I mean, because sometimes we isolate ourselves, right? Yeah. So that nobody knows.
Right.
We do it in hiding.
Yes. Nobody knew because I was, again, I'm I'm not somebody that's out partying and, like, you know, popping pills with anybody else or smoking pot, nothing like that. I really kept it so close to my vest because I did feel like if anybody catches onto that I have an issue here, I'm going to have to give this up. And I don't know how I'm going to get through the days without feeling this way.
Because you knew the feeling of a detox and you didn't want to do that again, right?
Yeah. Well, yes. But the big thing was I didn't think that I would be a good mother if I didn't have these stimulants in me, because I had ended up becoming very addicted to opioids and Adderall. So both in for my chemicals were stimulants, high stimulants. And I'm like a very low energy person to begin with. I've always been a low energy person. And then you put a toddler in front of me who's like nonstop. And I needed that boost, you know, or I thought I did. I thought I'll be a terrible mother to my son if I don't have some kind of stimulant in me to keep me going and keep me up with him and da 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 da. But it just didn't work. It gets to the point where you have to take the drugs just to feel normal. You're no longer getting high or feeling good. You just take them or drink so you can feel
function
normal and mm-hmm. function. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, I know we're kind of jumping ahead, but that's what ended up happening with me. By the time I went into rehab, I was taking 30 opioids a day and about 10 Adderall, and that was just to sustain me so I wouldn't get sick.
Mm-hmm.
And it,
so at what point did your family get involved?
Oh right. So my family got involved when I started getting arrested, and it was really my parents that have always been close with me. I ended up getting a divorce when my son was 2, and ended up moving in with my parents. They needed to help me, but I was thick into my addiction at this time, and they did not know. They suspected something was off, but they just figured it was, you know, going through a divorce and all that stuff. So the police were calling, knocking on the door, looking for me, because I was passing false prescriptions, which is a felony. And I was getting caught, you know, and they were looking for me.
And you talk about this in the book, too, because they were on to you. And you end up, here you are, divorced with a little kid.
Yeah.
And the cops show up at your parents' door. What was that day like?
I wasn't home when they showed up. But it wasn't a good day. I came home later and they were both, I remember perfectly, they were both in the kitchen and they said, you know, we have a problem here. And I denied it because I was so ashamed. And that's the whole denial, you know, feels the shame is like, no, I don't have a problem. And then the denial is like, oh my gosh, I'm lying to everybody.
Right.
And that's shameful. But here's the thing. There's nothing to be ashamed about when you have an addiction, a substance use disorder. There's nothing to be ashamed about, but I didn't know that then because I didn't know anything about the disease.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, you know, you got to turn yourself in. And I said, oh, great. So I did. And luckily, every time I got caught, I didn't have to pay a bond because they just said, make sure you show up to court. We're not going to. And I did, you know, and I was put on probation and all of this.
Did you do any jail time?
No, I did not. By the grace of God, I did not. I mean, I spent one day in a jail cell.
That's enough.
That was more than enough. But guess what? That didn't keep me from not.
Still didn't scare you straight, huh?
It was horrifying, but the minute I got out of there, I got in my car, I just popped a pill and I was off and feeling great. And I talk about this in the book too, that experience of being in a jail cell and having all of these prisoners from the prison in Niantic come in, And I got a real taste of what it would be like to be in jail. And it was terrifying. And then I started to detox during that time.
Right, because that's a tough one.
Yeah.
Again, we're speaking with Deb Lawless Miller, and she is the author of her own story, really, called One Little Pill, The Chase, The Crash, The Choice. And if you want to jot this down, if you're interested in getting Deb's book, it really is an intense and open read, really for anybody, whether you're suffering from addiction or a loved one is. We all know somebody. And you can get this book on barnesandnoble.com, and also it's available on Amazon. So let's get to the point now. And, you know, as somebody in recovery myself, people say, well, what was your rock bottom? Mm-hmm. I mean, I had a lot of rock bottoms. And I don't believe that people have to hit rock bottom to figure it out, right? Mm-hmm. But we're so sick that sometimes we need other people around us to help us figure it out.
Right.
So then what happens after that? So are you a convicted felon?
No, because by the time I was able to get in front of the judges, I had 6 months of sobriety. I had gone through rehab, and I was like, there's no way I'm ever turning back. Like, so I did get 2 years of probation, and so, you know, that was almost 20 years ago.
You're lucky.
Coming up on 20 years, right?
Good.
I am so lucky.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I as soon as I went into rehab and I learned about recovery and the disease of substance use disorder, I was like, oh my gosh, I couldn't even believe it. Like, I just thought it was me being weak-minded, and it's not. So yeah. I learned all of this. You know, fast forward 8 years into recovery, you know, life, just because you're sober and working the program doesn't mean that life is going to be perfect and a bed of roses. It's far from it. Mm-hmm. And you've got to learn to feel all of your emotions when you're sober. And so I'm eight years sober, and my son is 13, and he's diagnosed with bone cancer. And I'm a single mom. My ex is struggling with his own issues, mental health and substance use. And I am just, you know, wow, I'm all alone. And I'm focused on my son. And what I did, that is when my faith really came into play. I've always known God, but I've known of him, but I've never known him. You know, I really leaned into my faith during that time. And I had, and you can read it in the book, I've had a couple different spiritual awakenings where prayer miracles, mm-hmm. they really are miracles, and they are prayer based. So you can absolutely, you can read about it in the book. And that just cemented my faith even more. So, and you had mentioned, like, this is a good book for people to read who, you know, are struggling and they don't know what to do and they're scared and they don't. I talk a lot about my experience in rehab. I talk a lot about the 12 steps that you go through when you're in recovery, and just about, you know, that you can do it no matter what position you're in, no matter where you are, you know, there's a life waiting for you in recovery. And so many of my other people that have read the book that only have somebody that they know that's in recovery, they're like, we never knew. We learned so much from this book, and it helps us tremendously with our loved ones, understanding why they do what they do and all of that.
So what happened with Hunter's bone cancer diagnosis?
So he's recovered. He ended up losing his leg, unfortunately. So he's an above the knee amputee, but he's healthy. The cancer's gone. He's just celebrated 10 years in remission, and he's beautiful.
And you have a new life partner now.
New. He's coming up on 10 years.
Oh, okay. Well, that's not so new.
Yeah, but Kevin is awesome, and he makes every day new.
Yeah.
He really does.
Well, and that's a big piece of staying sober too, is having support in your life, right?
Right.
You had your family support. You've got Kevin in your life.
Yeah.
Your son Hunter is doing well now, mm-hmm. On with his life. So what is your advice for our listeners, Deb? You know, thank you first for sharing your experience. It really is a good book, and it's an easy read, and it's you're so open and honest in this book, which I guess you needed to be. Yeah. But again, the name of the book is One Little Pill, The Chase, The Crash, The Choice. What do you have to say to people as we wrap this up?
I just want anybody to know that's struggling right now and they don't know what to do or how to do it, or they're ashamed. It's you are denying yourself a beautiful, free, joyous and free life by not entering into recovery. Most importantly, understand that you are not alone.
Right.
I felt very alone. And you're not alone. And you're going to meet the most wonderful, true, salt of the earth people that are really going to change your life. So please reach out if I can be of any help to anybody as well. Conversations or helping them find meetings or whatever that might be. I'm happy to help.
Because it's different for everybody.
Right.
And like you said, you wrote this book. Part of your reason for that was there's a lot of books on the shelves from celebrities.
Mm-hmm.
But this is your real story. This is your story, Deb. And it's very helpful. It's very heartwarming. And I hope it gives people hope. I really do. So we encourage you to go to barnesandnoble.com. And also, the book is available on Amazon. It's One Little Pill, The Chase, The Crash, The Choice. And Deb, I know this is the first time that you've really talked about the book, but it's going to be coming up as an audiobook as well. Where can people find you?
You can go to deblawlessmiller.com for my website and my blogs. I write a weekly blog on recovery.
Oh, so again, all together, Deb, D-E-B, Lawless, L-A-W-L-E-S-S, Miller, M-I-L-L-E-R.com. It was an absolute pleasure. And thank you, my sober friend, for telling your story.
Of course. Thank you.
And we couldn't do this without all of you. Thank you for tuning into this edition of News You Can Use right here on WTIC News Talk 1080.